As we look at the goals that Matthew has as he tries to put this forward and teach people about Jesus Christ and who he was, we see in the very beginning, he starts out, right, with this genealogy. And he says, here's who Jesus was from his lineage. But what is he trying to convey with that? What's the main line of these lineages, and who does he start with? Yeah, he starts with Abraham. And that's where the major promises came into the people. And then he goes and he says he's the son of Abraham and the son of who else? David. That showing the kingship that Jesus is going to take. But he calls him the Christ, the Messiah, the one who is from God, the anointed one. And so he's going to have to present that as part of his picture as well. That's the first story. And then you get him adding to that the childhood events. And over again, we saw in the first few chapters, what kinds of things do we see Matthew saying about all of the things that are happening to Christ before he's even really responsible for anything? So it can be fulfilled, right? Just like it was written, just like it was written. And he's already done that multiple times. So we have the lineage, we've got his upbringing, and then last week we looked briefly at the baptism of Christ, where the Holy Spirit descended upon him, and he begins his mission. And now, immediately following that, if you look at chapter 4, just kind of as a sideline there, look at chapter 4 and verse 17. It says, from that time onward. Now, what did he finish there in the first part of chapter 4? That was the temptation of Christ. So we have all of these qualifications that he has, all this fulfilled prophecy, but now we have that Christ has stood up to Satan, stood up to the evil one, and been triumphant there. Again, quoting Chris Scripture the whole way, the Old Testament Scriptures. And from that time, Jesus starts his ministry. So now his work has started for certain. And if you look at this work, the first things he lists in the next few verses, as he goes on, he's walking by Galilee, he starts collecting his disciples, he's going to be a teacher, and he's going to have disciples following him and listening to him and learning from him as a teacher. But then it also talks about he's going about, he's teaching, proclaiming the gospel. But look at verse 24. The news about him went into all Syria, and they brought to him all who were ill, taken with various diseases and pains and demoniacs and epileptics and paralytics, and he healed them. And great multitudes followed him from Galilee. So his the beginning of his ministry, again, Matthew's not trying to be chronological here. Think of it as him putting these pieces together of who is this Jesus. And he first says he's got the right lineage, prophecy's fulfilled, and now he's performing miracles. What does that mean? Remember when Peter was asked? We've been studying this on Acts, right? When Peter was brought before the council, and he was asked a question, he had two things. He said, by what power do you do this, and in whose name do you do this? Right? Two essential things they would have to figure out based on what was going on. What are the options for by what power they could perform these kinds of works? God or the devil? I mean, it's, you know, they accused Christ at one point of doing these things by the power of Beelzebub. So that's the power. Now he's also got to figure out in what name, by what authority does he do these things? Now, did other prophets in the old law have the ability to do miracles? Okay, so up until this point, we really haven't exceeded what other prophets were capable of doing, other than this litany of all of these, it has been fulfilled things, right? But now we get to a point where Jesus sits down, and he's got a lot of people that are very interested in him. You can imagine back in that day, when their spirits were down, and they're trying to decide what is the fate of the Jewish people as a whole. Because for 400 years, we haven't heard from our God. Listening to an interesting series on the story of the Jews, did you realize at this point in time, there's a temple, and Herod the Great has rebuilt the temple. What's in the Holy of Holies? It's empty. It's empty. Where is God? He's supposed to be there. We haven't heard from him. And now this Messiah, this Jesus comes on the scene. And he starts working these miracles. And then we see in the beginning in chapter 5, look at those first couple of verses there, where it says that he goes up into the mountain. The multitudes are following him, and he goes up into the mountain, and then he sits down to teach. The mountain motif you'll find a lot in Matthew. There's 6 or 7 times where it talks about Jesus going up in the mountain, sometimes to be alone, sometimes to pray, sometimes to teach his disciples. Who else went up to the mountain? Yeah, I think we've got here, in addition to Jesus actually doing that, I think Matthew's emphasis is going to make a comparison here. Because this first sort of discourse that he has, there's some question. People say, well, was it just teaching his disciples or was it teaching the multitudes? Well, when you look at this first couple of verses, it says that the multitudes were following, he went up into the mountains. Somebody take a look at the last verse of chapter 7. What does it say there? The last verse of chapter 7. And the multitudes were amazed. Why? Because he taught as one having authority, and not as the scribes and the Pharisees. Was this all one sermon, this 5, 6, and 7? Or is this a collection of lessons that Jesus taught over time? You know, the way Matthew writes, we really don't know. But it doesn't matter. It could all be one lesson, and it could have been a long lesson. Or it could have been a collection that he's putting together. The point is, now Jesus, this first discourse that Matthew is going to present, is got a function. And if you look at these chapters and you say, what is it that he's trying to get across to people? Well, I think there's a number of lessons, but I'd like to group them into a category of what it means to live for God. Now, he's going to have some other discourses where he's going to talk about discipleship. And there's a lot of subcategories that we have to cover here. But he's got to first get the right character identified for his disciples. How are they supposed to live? What are they supposed to do? What does it mean to be a disciple, not just of Jesus? We're going to see that that's an emphasis at some point. But a follower of God, the way God wanted people to follow him, from the beginning. When he starts out here, what do we call this first section here in chapter 5? Everybody, the Beatitudes, right? Okay, blessed are they. And we could spend a lot of time on these, but he talks about blessed are the poor, blessed are those who mourn, those who are gentle, those who are merciful, those who are pure in heart, those who are peacemakers. What are those attributes? What do they represent? What are they in people? How does this relate to how we live for God? Now, blessed are the poor. If he'd have just left it there, you think there would have been a lot of people who would have agreed with that statement? I think there's a lot of people in Galilee that were already poor, right? So somebody tell them, you're poor and you're blessed, that's not going to help them a whole lot. But he said, poor in what? Poor in spirit. That doesn't sound like a good way of going together. What does he mean by poor in spirit? Humble. Recognizing their condition before God. And doesn't each of these kind of deal with that relationship before God? Blessed are those who are peacemakers. Peacemakers with whom? Man and God. A lot of these, and doesn't it boil back to a lot of when you look at the Ten Commandments even back then? You've got the relationship between man and God and the relationship between people. And those are the relationships that get emphasized. And the first thing he pulls together and he says, you're going to be my disciple, then let's look at who's blessed here, who's happy, whatever way you want to interpret those words. What are the qualities that I'm looking for in someone? And it might not be the qualities that everybody's initially thinking. Debbie taught a class one time as they were young kids on what it would mean to have a king. They're going to pick a king, right? And what kind of attributes would you like for your king? And one of the kids was like, oh, they need to be a warrior, right? I mean, back there, it's a boy, right? Obviously, got to be a warrior. And another one was talking about they need to be strong, need to be smart. And one of the little girls said, and they need to be a Republican. Everybody has their idea of what would make an ideal person here, right? And Jesus is saying, okay, here's my ideal person. And it might not go exactly like what you would have thought. But then as he says, here's what's right in your heart. He said, then blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness. Now that might strike a chord as well. And he's going to say that people here, you listening to me, you're going to be persecuted. You think the Jews in that time, that place, would have considered themselves to be persecuted already? Certainly. Certainly. And so Jesus is, you know, this is kind of a little bit of an odd thing when you look at it. Because while we look at this chapter, and some of the commentaries, you'll see that it's listed as the, you know, Christian attitudes or the, you know, Christian teaching. We're not there yet, folks. The church isn't there yet. He's still talking to people who in their time and in their way need to follow their God. And he's going to give them a lesson in how to do that. But did it just apply to them? You see, I think the main thing is this is a lesson for all times. Then, now, future. What does God want out of people? What has he always wanted out of people? So he says, but if you do these things, you're going to be persecuted. Now we've got, following that, being the salt of the earth and the light of the world and to let their light shine. I love the salt part. Because sometimes I think we get it wrong. Well, we've talked about it before, though. What are the attributes and qualities of salt? Okay. Is preserving, okay. Seasoning. It does, in some sense. My favorite is if you've got a cut in your hand, you get your hand in salt water, what happens? It stings like mad, right? So when Paul says, let your speech be seasoned with salt, is that what he's talking about? You know, cut people to the quick and make them sting. No, what he's talking about is something pleasant. How many of you put salt in your food? Why?
Make it taste better.
Exactly right. And that's what we're supposed to be. We're supposed to make the world taste better. Now, how does that relate to right before when you said you're going to be persecuted? And yet, your attitude has got to be to make the world better. And you've got to be light. Being a light's a real pain. What happens to lights if they're set on a hill? They get noticed, right? Why do we build lighthouses on rocky places? So that the ships don't crash in the rocks, right? Why? Because they can see it. That's his point. You're supposed to make the world a better place. And in your own way, you're supposed to be seen. Now, that's a little different because most people's attitude is going to be, okay, the less the better, right? You know, the more you blend in, the less problem you have. And that's where we're not really supposed to be blending in. So here's his attitude. We've got to have the right personal parts with us in terms of our relationship and our internals, that how we deal with man and deal with God. We've got to be willing to put ourselves on the line and understand that that might come with some persecution. But as he's saying this, and he's talking to those people, and they've come out to hear a teacher, he then has to say, but I want you to understand something about God's law. Look at what he says there beginning in verse 17. Do not think that I came to abolish the law. This is a critical statement for him to make before he launches into the rest of his teaching. Do not think that I came to abolish the law. If he starts teaching things that are contrary to what the Pharisees or the scribes or the chief priests are teaching, what is the possible thing that could be leveled against him? Okay, close. Heresy, blasphemy. You know, that he is setting aside the most sacred thing that they had. How did the Jews survive for the 1,500 years of all that they went through to the point that they got to where in Jesus' time? It was because of that book that they had. It was because of the Torah. It's how they've continued to survive, is because of that. But are they using it right? That's Jesus' next issue that he has to deal with. Are they really doing the way that God wants them? And so he wants to make it clear, I did not come to change this. What did he come to do? What does he say after that? I came to fulfill it. And so now he's got this juxtaposition there. He says, in fact, not a teeny little bit of it's going to be gone away. Jot or tittle, little things, okay, that you might even miss. You know, cross, dotting an I and crossing a T is probably the equivalent. You know, if you're reading through a sentence and somebody forgot to dot an I when they're writing by hand, you could go right past it and never miss it, right? But he said, even that's important. Even that's important. And I'm not going to change anything, even that small, until. Until what? Until it's fulfilled, right? Until it's fulfilled. And so he sets that up as his major principle. I'm going to be telling you this. And now he goes in, and beginning after his affirmation of the validity of God's law, he's going to start on telling them how to properly interpret it. Now, you have to understand also that during this time, this is a very famous time for teachers. There's a lot of Jewish teachers wandering around. They've got groups of Essenes out on the side saying, we need to just, you know, separate ourselves from everybody and cut ourselves off from everyone else, and that's how we'll be pleasing to God. We've got zealots who are out here saying, well, if we just, you know, kill all the Romans, then we'll be happy. We've got Pharisees who are trying to be really strict about every little thing, and they've got, you know, every little law nailed down to an exacting point. I've got Sadducees who are going, yeah, you know, we can adopt some of the Greek stuff here. That's not a big deal. And, yeah, okay, we'll bend whatever, you know, and we can all still get along and be happy. They were sort of the ecumenical group of the day. There were people like Hillel and people like Shammai who were well-known teachers. You get a teacher in Acts. Who is that? Gamaliel, okay? Who was one of his prime students? Saul and Paul. So we've got these people teaching, and it's into that group that Jesus is putting his counterpoint. And he says, you have heard it said. Now, we're going to see that phrase several times as you go through there. Go ahead.
Well, let me finish off, but before you get to verse 21.
Uh-huh. Go right ahead. Absolutely.
And that would have been an extremely shocking statement to say you got to be
better than them. Better than them. Good point. And it does fit in right with where he's fixing to go. So thank you for bringing that up. Your righteousness must exceed that of the scribes and the Pharisees. Now, those would have been the ones that the people would have looked to as being the most righteous. Especially the Pharisees. And we'll talk about them as we go. They were the most righteous. But Jesus is saying, you as individuals, all of you listening here, you got to do better than that. Now, the next thing he says is, and I'm going to show you how to do better. I'm going to show you how to do better. The Great Council had three principles that were the foundation of what they tried to teach and do. Principle number one, do everything with deliberation. Think about it. Make sure that you've thought it well. Yes, Joe. I think he's talking to both. He's talking to his disciples who are close, but it doesn't say how many disciples there were other than there were lots. And if you look at the tail end, it says the multitudes were hearing him as well. My personal feeling, and I have no way of proving this one way or the other, I think this is an accumulation of things. Some of these would have been to his disciples in a close format. Some of it would have been to the multitudes. He clearly taught these same principles to both in different occasions. And we've got different times when he's standing up and teaching these. So when you look at that, the particular audience there is still those who are coming to listen because they want to hear what he has to say about being a follower of God.
And we know that there are certain portions of this Sermon on the Mount that are taught at a different time frame chronologically in Jesus' life. But you and I both have probably preached the same sermon more than once.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think there's lots of people listening to this. You know, this is not done for just a little group. They are maybe the principal listeners at that point. And that also, it also mirrors a little bit about how teaching was done then. When a rabbi, a teacher, would sit down, the people in sort of the front row would be his closest disciples. And then there would be multiple rows after that, or, you know, as people would listen in, anybody was welcome. Depending on what the space constraints were. But the closer you sat was sort of like a sign of your affinity for the teacher. Which I think is why in today's classrooms, most people sit in the back row, right? See, I'm talking to you guys back in the back row there now. But he's trying to get these points across when he says, now, I'm going to say these things. And he says, you have heard it said. Now, that contrasts with how he said some other things. How does he normally open up something when he's talking about an Old Testament writing? What's another way he says that? It is written. Or is it not written? It is written. Is that what he says here? He says, you've heard it said. Now, some of these are going to be direct quotes from the Old Testament scriptures. But he's going to start showing them how to look at this. Be deliberate in judgment. Do everything with thought. The second thing was to raise up many disciples. That's what he's looking at doing here as a teacher. He is teaching. But the third thing was to build a fence around the Torah. To understand what the guidelines of the Torah were and to set some boundaries so that you understood where you were in relation to God's law. That's the principle. Now, he said, you've heard it said, you shall not do murder. Think anybody there would have had any problem with that as a decree? No. No problem. Don't do murder. What does he say? But I say to you. What did he say? Don't get angry. Was he saying that it was a sin to get angry? Trick question here, right?
No, he didn't. Because he got angry when he went into the temple later on.
Okay. Can it be a sin? It can be a sin, but it's not necessarily a sin, right? So what's the point? Why does he bring anger into it when he started out with murder? There you go. That's one of the paths there. You're not going to kill someone that you're not mad at. Today there seems to be a lot of senseless killing. I'm not sure that that applies in absolutely every case, but you understand that even today in the murders, how many of them are domestic violence, Joe? But people that know each other, they just get mad, and some gets in an argument, and they get carried away, and they kill somebody. So what's Jesus said? If you don't want to kill somebody, what's the first thing? Don't get mad at them. And if you see that going a little further, and you start calling them names, now you're getting too close to the line. You see how that goes? So what he's saying is, pick the path that avoids that end line you don't want to get to. So he's taking an easy one for starters. Everybody goes, oh, that sounds pretty good. I get that. But we're going to start getting a little harder here, right? Because then he comes down and he says, you've heard it said that you shall not commit adultery. But notice that he ties this all the way through with adultery and divorce and remarriage. And this was a big issue during their time, with two schools on very different issues on how that was to be resolved. And Jesus is coming down very firmly on the side of saying, there is only one cause for that, and that's if one party commits fornication. And that if that's not the case, this whole discussion of divorce, which goes back to Deuteronomy 24, there are arguments on what does that mean when you give your wife a writing of divorcement. Jesus is saying, really, what he's saying here is, no. From the beginning, just like he said in other places, this wasn't the way it was. So let me show you how it goes. How do you avoid that? You have heard it say, you shall not commit adultery, but I say to you that everyone who looks on a woman to lust after her has committed adultery with her already in his heart. What does he mean by that? Look at the previous one. How do you get down that road to adultery? You start wandering, right? The eye starts wandering. And so the eye starts wandering, what's the next thing he says there? Pluck it out, okay? Does he really mean he wants you to mutilate yourself? You see what he's doing there? He's building this barrier. He's saying, if you notice that you're starting to wander and starting to look, the best thing to do is to recognize that and to stop it. Because therein lies the danger. You're heading down the wrong path. Draw the line. Back away so that you don't even come close to where God doesn't want you to be. Okay, that's a little tougher. But okay, we can see that one. Some of the people might not have agreed with it. You've heard, you shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. And in each of these so far, he's been quoting Old Testament passages, hasn't he? And then he's telling them how to interpret them. Now this one starts getting against some of the things that they had there. You know, he talked about this in other places too, where they'd start making these vows and they would vow by one thing or another. And depending on what you vow by as to which one was more important, right? And what's he saying? It's not the object. It doesn't matter what you vow on. You have promised something. What's it better to do? Yeah, keep your mouth shut. Don't make any rash vows. Don't make any vows. Okay? Just do your best. Don't make any vows. Because if you vow to do something before God, do it. Don't even think about messing with it. Do it. Don't even try to think of a way to wiggle out of it. Do it. Because it's before God. See, doesn't that go back to the character of the people he's been talking about? And so he's coming with these relationships here. And he's talked about murder. He's talked about adultery. He's talked about vows. Verse 38 is where now we're going to start getting a little tougher. You've heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Is that an Old Testament quote? Absolutely is. But how is he interpreting it here? But I say to you, do not resist him who is evil, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you, take your shirt, let him have your coat also. And whoever shall force you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks you, and do not turn away from him who wants to borrow from you. He's really putting a tough load on him there when he says, turn the other cheek. But what's the context of all of the times in the Old Testament when it says eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth? It's judicial punishment. It is where people have come in and there were witnesses and there were convictions and someone was convicted of something. And then what's the point behind eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth? Justice. The punishment to fit the crime. But isn't it easy to just kind of skip that whole judicial part? And if somebody does something wrong to you, you look at that and you go, eye for an eye. It never works that way, does it? Somebody punches a kid, what do? You've got to punch them harder, right? And that's their eye for an eye version, is to punch them harder. And it just escalates out of there. What's really Jesus talking about here? Is he talking about don't take anybody to court, don't try to resist, don't try to stand up against evil? He's really dealing with the whole concept of vengeance, isn't he? And isn't that actually the right Old Testament principle? What did God say in the Old Testament? Vengeance is mine. Okay? Now, can you see where they might have gotten kind of the idea of this other thing? Some of the Psalms of David. Does it sound like when David says, and I hope that all the soldiers will grab their kids and dash their heads against the rocks? There's a word for that kind of psalm. What do we call it? Everybody remember? It's an imprecatory psalm, an imprecation against people. They're wishing them harm and evil. But even if you look at those imprecatory psalms, what's the point that David's getting across? He wants God's judgment. He's not wanting to take the vengeance. He doesn't want to go out there and personally do that. He wants God to do the judging. And so what he's telling these people is, your Pharisees and your others have started getting a little too far down the line of taking this vengeance stuff on yourselves. If you're going to be a disciple of mine, then vengeance is God's. And if it's God's, when somebody comes up and abuses you, do you hit them back? No. Now we're getting a little tougher. Because see, now it sounds like, okay, we're not supposed to be, I thought we were supposed to be, against evil. And the Roman Empire is evil. And there's all kinds of evils in the world. And we can fight against that, right? And Jesus is saying, let's back up and see what God wants you to do. What God wants you to do is leave vengeance to him. And then he finishes it up with one that I think would have been very difficult for a lot of them to swallow. He says, you have heard it said, you shall love your neighbor. Is that an Old Testament quote? Absolutely. Right out of Leviticus. But he says, what's the next one he says? And hate your enemies. Is that an Old Testament quote? You're not going to find it anywhere. And that's why he said, you've heard it said. You've heard it said. Love your neighbor. A Jew in that time, how would he have interpreted that? Who are the Jews? They're your neighbors. Who are the Gentiles? They're the enemies. Right? And so when he says you're to love your enemy, I think there would have been a collective gasp. Because I think a lot of people would have interpreted that as Loving those people around you that we don't even associate with. But isn't that really what God meant all along? Was God meaning that they were to just only be looking out for the Jews and, you know, the Gentiles were this anathema thing? Now, were there people that he said, kill them all? Yeah, and it was part of punishment that was clearly laid out in the sins that they had done. But over and over again, you know, when you look at the laws for the Passover and what they're supposed to do, you find these little line where it says, and the stranger that is in your midst. And when someone came in from the outside and he said, you don't treat them any differently because you once were a slave in Egypt. Over and over again, there are places in the old law where this principle stands. Jesus isn't teaching something new here. But he's going against what was common in that day and in that time and what a lot of the Pharisees were teaching. And now that's what's going to start getting him into this real comparison with him and his teaching and the disciples that he wants as opposed to the other disciples. So he goes through this proper interpretation of the law and how to do that right. But then he has to deal with the attitude. Beware of practicing your righteousness before men. So you could be good about following all this proper interpretation of the law. But you got to do it with the right attitude, right? And what attitude is he asking him to do it for? He says, if you fast, how do you do that? I know most of you have read through some of this before. So is that he said, when the Pharisees fast, what do they do? Oh, yeah, they're looking pitiful. They're looking sad. You know, you can just tell they're hungry. Must be fasting. And what does he say to do? Basically, he says, comb your hair, brush your teeth, look presentable, go out. Nobody else is going to know. Nobody else is going to know. And that's the way it should be. Because who is this for anyway? It's for God. And if God knows, that's enough. So let's get the right attitude, folks. We're not obeying God to be looked at nicely by everybody else. That's not why we do it. We do it because that's the way God wants us to do it. So we get the attitude adjusted. And so he goes in and he talks about this attitude. When you pray, some people love to stand and pray. Others, he wants you to go into an inner room, shut the door and pray. Even the Lord's Prayer here that people call the Lord's Prayer, he's really teaching them how to pray. And he says, now, when you're in secret, what are you going to pray for? Well, it starts with this great one in terms of the request. He says, thy kingdom come. And do you remember what John the Baptist said when he started this whole thing with Jesus? What was his cry? The kingdom of heaven is at hand. And Jesus is saying, and you pray for that kingdom. You pray for it to come. And you pray for it to come quickly. What else did he ask him to pray for? What we need daily. I love Proverbs 30 in that, you know, where don't give me too much unless I'm proud. Don't give me not enough unless I steal and profane God. Just enough. Enough so that we don't have to go to either extreme on that. And Jesus said, give me my daily bread. Give me what I need to live. But then look at that. Forgive us our debts as we also have forgiven our debtors. Sometimes I think we miss that a little bit. God was willing to forgive us our debts only after we had come and begged him. When did he put everything into place to forgive us our debts? Long before some of us were born, right? So people argue, well, I don't have to forgive somebody unless they actually come and ask me. Let them beg first, and then I'll think about it, and then I'll be gracious and I'll forgive them. Is that what he's saying here? He said, we're going to forgive people because God forgave us. That's the attitude that he's wanting. So a lot of this, even in this prayer here, is relating to the attitude that he wants out of people. If you do not forgive men, then your Father will not forgive your transgressions. And he talks about the fasting. Okay. Now, he's going to talk about priorities. Verses 19 to 34. I think there really he's talking about priorities. So we've talked about what kind of heart we have. We talk about how we're going to interpret the law. We talk about the attitude you got to have. And now, where do your priorities lie? What does he start that out with? Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, but instead, what? Put treasures in heaven. Put treasures in heaven. I got to tell you, folks, if we're going to store up treasures in heaven, there's a different definition of treasures than what most people would have in this world, right? Because most people in this world, what do they think of as treasures? Wealth. Got things. Okay? Seen the bumper sticker, the one who dies with most toys wins? Yeah. Is that what we're talking about here? It's kind of hard to stick those treasures in heaven, right? Because when you die, they're all going to stay right here. They're on loan, folks. They're on loan. So what treasures are we going to lay up in heaven? Huh? Eternal inheritance. When you're going to lay up treasure in heaven, the treasure you're really hoping for is that ability to be with God when you die. That's the big treasure. So how do you get there? Well, that's what this sermon's all about, isn't it? You have the right attitude, and you get your priorities straight, and you interpret the law correctly. Now, when he's looking at these things, he says, treasures in heaven, no one can serve two masters. That's really the same concept, is it not? Treasures in heaven, treasures on earth, two masters. Same concept. And then he starts out and he says, do not be anxious for your life and what you shall eat and what you shall drink. And I know most of you are familiar with this, but we go all the way down and just 33 and verse 34, you've got to read, right? But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you. Therefore, do not be anxious for tomorrow will take care of itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. I agree with that sentiment 100%, right? Maybe since borrowing trouble. But what's he really saying there? Seek first his kingdom, his righteousness. What's this section about? Priority. Where's your priority? What comes first? What runs your life? What are the things that you think about when it's time to make a decision? Is it based on all the stuff you got to do here and the way that life does? Yeah, well, sometimes it is. I mean, some of that's got to come into play. But in the right priority, right? That's the important part. Is it where's your priority lay? And he says, don't be anxious. What is anxious? Worried. Yeah, don't worry. Oh, that's really tough, isn't it? That's got to be one of the hardest things, second to not misusing your tongue, is not worrying. We're born to worry. How many of your parents? Most of us in here, right? We've got lots of parents around. You ever worry about your kids? Yeah, all the time, right? So is he saying you just can't worry about anything?
We worry, but we trust.
Okay. Yeah, we're concerned. And it's okay to be concerned about things. But trust in God that he'll take care of it. Because when it really boils down to it, how much can you fix things by worrying about them? Isn't that the just sort of consternation of worry? Is it doesn't fix anything and just makes it worse for you? But he's not saying don't be concerned. Of course you're going to be concerned.
That really is not the point of what he's saying, but also I think it's interesting to point out that if you control your anger, control your lust, control all these things, you'll have a lot less to worry about generally.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. That's I think as people center their lives on these principles in general, that it starts reducing the worry that we have in our life. That's a definite side benefit of it. So he says here, let's get the priorities straight. But then when he goes on into chapter 7, we've got a little bit of a journey here to make. And we've got to talk about some relations again. Don't judge lest you be judged. Does that mean that we can't pronounce any kind of judgment on anyone? If we go on and read through that, what's the real point that he's trying to make? Well, that's part of it, but only under what conditions? What's the conditions, the caveats that he puts here? Yeah, look to yourself first, right? If I'm guilty of violating something, how effective am I as a teacher or as an example to tell somebody, well, you shouldn't be doing that? This doesn't work. Okay, you can't hold people to a different standard. You heard the expression, actions speak louder than words. Yeah, it fits here, doesn't it? That's what he's really saying. So he says, you be careful how you're going to apply this and how we're going to be doing this teaching, which they inevitably were going to have to go out and do. Because look to yourself first. Let's get this relation first there. Ask and it shall be given. What's your relationship with God? Seek and ye shall find. What's he really getting across there? What's the point? Ask and it shall be given. Seek and you shall find. Knock and it shall be opened unto you. Okay. And then he gives the example there, right, of who, what person asking for a loaf of bread would his father give him a snake? Is God going to just punish us? Now think about what the people there would have been thinking. 400 years of silence. God's abandoned us. We've just been left. We had the Greeks running all over us. Now the Romans are running all over us. Where is this prophecy? Where is this coming kingdom? And he says, no. And you ask. You petition your God. What's our relationship with God? Now, it says we can come boldly before his throne. But that doesn't mean we come demanding things of God, right? Marshall?
Well, I certainly think that at least part of it is talking about asking for physical blessings and so forth. It seems to me that when you put it in the context of the things that follow, that ultimately what it's getting at is asking and seeking for the spiritual guidance and the truth and how I can be a disciple, how I can, you know, all the things you're talking about, following God. And in light of back in verse 20 about the scribes and the Pharisees, don't be going to them. You know, you got to be better than them. And, you know, there is this better way that I'm teaching you with this. You need to seek it out.
Absolutely. Let's take a look at verse 12 of chapter 7. Therefore, however you want people to treat you, so treat them. For this is the law and the prophets. Now, there's different places where that same sentiment is stated, right? What do we kind of call that? The golden rule, right? And that's not who has the gold rules, okay? We call it the golden rule. I found it very interesting that there's a German saying that's very similar to this, and I won't slaughter the German for it, but I'll tell you the transcription for it. They say what you don't want other people to do to you, don't do to someone else. They sort of switched it there a little bit, right? I like this one better. Ever how you would like to be treated? You treat other people that way. And what if they don't treat you that way? Didn't he already cover that? Yeah. It doesn't matter. You still do that. He says, this is the law and the prophets. Sweeping statement there. What does that mean? These things I've been teaching up to this point, culminating in the sentence of your relationship with other people being, love your neighbor, treat them like you want them to be treated, like you would like to be treated. That's the law. When he says that, what he's saying is, that's what God always intended. This isn't new, folks. This is what God always intended. Now, as he continues on, enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is broad that leads to destruction, and many there are who enter it. For the gate is small and the way is narrow that leads to life, and few there are who find it. He's not just talking about something that's hard versus something that's easy. In the light of what he said before already, when we talked about interpreting the law correctly, drawing those right kinds of boundaries, the narrow path is simply the one that you have to look. When he's saying broad, every day, don't you make decisions about how you're going to say something, who you're going to communicate with, what you're going to do? I mean, the day is a non-ending chain of decisions that we make. And every one of those leads to other things that go on in our lives. And making the ones that look like they're heading in the right direction are the ones that we need to be doing. And how easy is it sometimes to kind of fall off of that path? To say the wrong thing at the wrong time. Or to slip up and say, oops, I really shouldn't have done it that way. and to start getting down closer into what he calls the broad path. See, the broad path is just easier, right? Yeah. When sometimes we go hiking on hills or whatnot, and one of our greatest challenges was going on a hike in Korea where all of the signs were in these funny little letters that I couldn't read, right? You know, there are all these sticks and lines and circles and stuff. And so trying to figure out where we were going was a little difficult. So you know what we did? You know what was one of the easiest things to do? Which path was wider and which one had more people on it? All right? And that's kind of an analogy to the way a lot of the world lives. What is it, even in our democracy, that makes things right? Whatever the majority wants. And what if the majority isn't in agreement with God's law? Oops, we have a problem. And if you don't start thinking like the majority, then you're the one who's got a problem, right? And folks, what this basically is saying is there's going to be lots of times when we're not going to be thinking like the majority. And God wants us to find that path. Not only did us have the right heart to be on that path, but that path that has the largest swath of staying out of the way of sin. That's the narrow path. And that's what we got to find. So he says, that's what you got to find. Now, he said a lot of things here. He's told people about how their heart has to be, how their attitude has to be, their proper treatment of the law, the priorities they need in their life, what their relationships have to be with other folks. He's talked about this journey of finding the right path. And then he has a conclusion. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and acts upon them may be compared to a wise man who built his house upon a rock. And the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew and burst against the house. And yet it did not fall, for it had been founded upon a rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act upon them will be like a foolish man who built his house upon the sand, and the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew and burst against that house, and it fell. And great was its fall. The challenge there is, all right, folks, we've had a big lesson here. There's lots of tough stuff. And things that have challenged folks. And things that a lot of the Jews listening to would have really had to think about, because this is not the way they would have normally thought about some of these things. Quite frankly, it's not the way a lot of people in the world today think about some of these things, right? So what is it going to be? House on the sand, house on the rock. Building on rock is tougher sometimes. It really is. But you know what? It's a lot more solid. And that's what Jesus is saying. So, where are you going to put your life? That's really what he's saying when he ends here. So he's out of this teaching the master, the first great discourse. And he ends it up by these great statements. And what are the next two verses? We covered those already. But it says, and they listened to him. Why? Because he taught as one having authority. Very different than what the other people were hearing from the scribes and the Pharisees and those other teachers. All right. Next week, Richard is going to be taking the next couple of chapters. And then the following week, Ken Smith. And I thought, oh, he's not, yeah. Yes, you agree to that. Okay, so I'll be gone for 2 weeks, but you'll have two good teachers in the interim. And when I get back, hopefully they'll be done with chapter 10, and we'll pick up with about chapter 11 at that point. So next week, take a look at chapters 8 and 9. All right? Thank you.